Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for the Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on December 3rd. I can't believe it's already the end of the year, but December 3rd is our next Practitioners Forum, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. You can hear the sound of my voice, and that means you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you enter it while logging on to the call and that you have a question. Or you can also go ahead and type the question in directly, and I'll just read it aloud. We will then, at that point, ask the questions, get everyone involved, and allow you an opportunity to come on. If you choose to come on live, or as I mentioned before, go ahead and type it in. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman has received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays on the first Tuesday of each month. This practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. Every other Tuesday of this month, we have a free webinar on different tax resolution topics. Keep an eye out for our invitations via email for more details. And if you forget when these happen, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. Remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. Before we get started on the questions themselves, I'm going to do a quick plug here. We do have our annual event that's coming up on November 14th. This is our annual event that we have. It's a full 8-hour event. We offer CPE for every one of those hours. And the focus is Tax and Tax Resolution Forum, where you're going to learn how to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most, and learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. I will be pushing a link to the event page, so for those of you who are interested or have not already signed up, register today. We do have the event coming up on November 14th. Now, for those of you that can't attend, different time zones, we do have a couple additional options. We are rebroadcasting the event on November 19th and 20th, and we're breaking up those sessions into four-hour sessions for the first half and the second half on each one of those days. So hopefully you can attend. I will push the link to the event page so you guys can go ahead and register. And as always, we will send you an email with a promotion for those of you who attended today. All right, let's go ahead and get started with the questions, Norman. The first round of questions here are from VIP members. Remember, as a VIP member, you do get priority during this forum. So you submit your question to us, and we make sure that we ask the question. First one is from Jason. He is an EA and a VIP member. His question is, what can I do if my clients have just informed me that he is in the middle of an audit, but looking at the forms, the final assessment has already been made, and the time to submit paperwork has passed? So what can you do?
Okay, so I'm assuming that what you're referring to is the notice of deficiency, but I'll back up. So normally during an audit, towards the end, the auditor will send the taxpayer a 30-day letter. And with the 30-day letter, it says, here's my proposed changes. And if you don't agree, contact me or my manager within 30 days, and we can go over your questions or concerns. If nothing gets resolved after that 30 days, then the notice of deficiency is issued. And a notice of deficiency allows the taxpayer to protest it by filing a petition in U.S. tax court. And in the upper right-hand corner, it gives the 90 days and the final date of when a tax court petition can be filed. After that date, the tax court loses jurisdiction on the case, and so a tax court petition, I guess you could file it, but it won't do any good. The IRS will object, and the petition will get dismissed. So let's assume that what you're saying is that the time to file a U.S. tax court petition protesting the audit has passed. What do you do? And the answer is an offer doubt as to liability. And so in the offer doubt as to liability, you can't say you owe nothing, but you can say, I owe much less than what was proposed. Usually audits are based on expenses were disallowed either because they were considered not necessary or because the taxpayer didn't have proper paperwork to support the expense. So the taxpayer may say, well, I've got proof of these expenses, but I couldn't find anything on these, and so I'll agree to owing X amount, but I dispute Y, and it will go to another auditor, and you could get the audit reconsidered through the doubt as to liability offer. So if it's too late to file a tax court petition, then an offer doubt as to liability is really your only other choice at this time.
All right. Thank you, Norman. I'm just reading some of the comments here. Okay. Moving on to the next question, Jason. Hopefully that answers your question. Next question is here from another VIP member, Steve, and Steve is in the EA. He's asking, I have a tax resolution client who owes $78,000 for tax years 2007 through 2009. This debt is currently with the IRS third-party debt collection agency, the CBE Group. The client has also not filed for tax years 2013 through 18, but should break even on those years, leaving just the $78,000 owed for the prior years. He goes on to explain the individual CSED dates for a lot of the liability. Summarizing here, he says, client makes W-2 wages of $97,000 per year, so not really an OIC candidate, he believes. He says he has two questions. Would paying 07-09 debt down to under $50,000 with a direct debit installment agreement make sense since the IRS has not issued any liens as of yet? And two, the IRS told me I have to deal with the third-party debt collector to get this resolved. Is that true? Is there a way to pull the negotiations back into the IRS collections division, or does that even matter in this case?
Okay, so to answer the first question, I mean, really, in terms of what to do first, I would suggest filing those delinquent returns for 13 through 18, even if he's not going to owe. The thing is, you can't enter into an installment agreement unless you're in compliance, because an installment agreement is a voluntary option that the IRS allows the taxpayer to enter into if the taxpayer is in compliance otherwise. So with outstanding non-filed returns, they're not even qualified to enter into an installment agreement. So the first step is to file tax years 13 through 18, and maybe there'll be some small refunds or something that could be applied to the 7 through 9 liability. But in any case, your first priority is to file the unfiled returns. Secondly, is that the debt is now with a third-party collection agency, and they are not as on top of things as the IRS is, and so the IRS issued a report last year, the Taxpayer Advocate Service, saying that IRS was actually losing money on these third-party debt collection agencies because they had to pay them, and the fees that they were paying the collection agencies was more than what the collection agencies were collecting. So the collection agencies are not doing a great job. So in a sense, maybe you're better off with the collection agency. And the reason I say that is because these all have CSEDs, that's collection statute expiration dates, sometime between 2021 and 2022. So we're talking like 2 or 3 years from now. And I know it looks like a long way, but I've had the cases where we just haven't heard anything from the third-party collection agencies after the initial letter, and time went on and the cases finally became uncollectible because they reached the CSET. So one strategy may be do nothing and see if you can ride it out to the CSETs. Paying it below $50,000 makes sense if you want to avoid tax lien, and if you want to pay it in a streamline, but also remember that there's an extended streamline for taxpayers that owe over $50,000 but below $100,000. And one difference between the streamline and the extended streamline is that the streamline is paid over 72 months, and the extended streamline is paid off over 84 months. And so you might actually come in with a smaller monthly payment if you don't pay it down and go with the extended streamline over 84 months. So that's another thing to consider. And about the IRS telling you that you're pretty much stuck with dealing with the third-party debt collector and that the case is out of their hands, that may or may not be true. It probably is, because they probably have some deal with the collection agency and they've already paid them or whatever, and so they're not going to get the case back. So if you don't want to deal with the third party, you may want to run it out. If you end up where you need to deal with them, you may want to keep the payment up, keep the amount owed over $50,000 and below $100,000 and do the 84-month payment plan, or pay it down below $50,000 and you do a 72-month plan, but you could avoid the tax lien. I don't know if they own a house, if there's equity in the house, so there's issues with that. Also, remember, when the CSED passes, the liens expire, but I don't think they're going to qualify for a streamline because they're going to say that it has to be paid off within the statute. So if the statute's going to expire in 2 or 3 years, they're going to want some payment plan that full pays within 3 years. So that's another thing. So that's another reason you may want to just try to write it out. But yeah, you know, streamline only works if there's more than 72 or more than 84 months left in the statute. If the statute has less than that to go, then they don't qualify for a streamline. So this taxpayer, I don't think would qualify for a streamline because he only has 2 or 3 years left in the statute, depending on the year.
And that's actually very important when dealing with these installment agreements, is you have to know what you're up against as far as a statute of limitation. The IRS will adjust the payment plan based on how much time is remaining. So thank you for that, Norman. Moving on to Thomas. Thomas is asking, taxpayer in Tennessee filed his 2018 tax return 2 days late due to a last-minute question on one of his 1099-Rs that did not reflect qualified charitable distribution made during 2018. The taxpayer understands that he should have filed for an extension and did not do so. Taxpayer sent a personal letter on July 9th to the IRS requesting first-time abatement of failure to file and failure to pay penalties. The IRS responded on October 8th, denying the penalty adjustment based upon failure to file an extension, stating that the taxpayer did not qualify for a first-time waiver abatement criteria. So the question is, should the taxpayer pursue an appeal? There are no additional reasons for the 2-day late than was already stated in the July 9th letter.
Okay, so to qualify for first-time penalty abatement, it has to be just that, first time. And so if the taxpayer owed or incurred a late filing or late payment penalty within 3 years prior to the 2018 year, then he doesn't qualify. So one thing you could do is order transcripts for 2015, 16, and 17, and you could see if there were any late payment or failure to pay or failure to file penalties. And if so, then they don't qualify for first time. But the other ground to abate penalty is under reasonable cause, which actually should be the first place that you look to abate a penalty. The first time penalty abatement may be easy, but the thing is, it's a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card. And the thing is, do you really want to use it if you don't have to? So I always recommend that first you try to abate it under reasonable cause. And if reasonable cause fails, then fall back on first-time penalty abatement. And reasonable cause in this case may be that it would have to be something to do with the tax preparer, and the tax preparer had a question about the 1099-R or something and dropped the ball on the extension. But in any case, I would look to a reasonable cause explanation for the penalty abatement first. If that fails and the first time penalty abatement fails, yeah, you can appeal it. But before you waste time and money appealing it, I would order the transcripts of the prior 3 years and see what there was that prevented them from getting the first time penalty abatement.
Yeah, Thomas, I know you say that the letter itself indicates that the reason why they're denying is failure to file an extension, but I've never seen that, so I'm curious about that. Maybe we'll take this
also
off.
The letter should explain the appeal rights.
Yeah. So I'm curious about that, Thomas. Maybe you can send us a copy of that letter, or we can review it, because I do want to see if failure to file an extension automatically disqualifies for penalty abatement. But thank you for that. Okay, moving on to the next question here. This is Roger, an EEA, also a VIP member. He's asking, I just received a call from an employee from a business that owes 6+ years of payroll tax liability. The IRS is requesting a meeting with the employee to ask them questions about their involvement in the company's operations. The employee is uneasy about meeting with the IRS without representation. Can I represent the employee without representing the business? Any advice is helpful.
Okay, so it looks like what they're doing is they're holding what's called a 4180 interview because the interview is for the purpose of completing a form 4180, and the purpose of the form is to determine whether or not the, we'll call it witness, is subject to trust fund recovery penalty. So in this case, it's the employee. So when you ask if you can represent the employee without representing the business, the answer is yes. My only concern would be if you do, if the employee learned about you through the employer because you do the employer's payroll tax returns or whatever, there may be an issue of conflict of interest. But if you don't represent the business, you could represent the employee, and you would want to go to the 4180 interview with them and answer a series of questions, and they want to determine whether or not the employee was a responsible person. And the things that they're going to look at are the employee's duties and the employee's knowledge, which goes towards willfulness. So I guess really important is whether or not the employee had the ability to sign checks and whether the employee determined which checks would be paid and which checks wouldn't be written. Because what happened here is the IRS wasn't being paid, but other creditors were, probably, you know, rent or vendors or wages, utilities, whatever were being paid before the IRS. And so the IRS takes the position that they should have been paid first. And so that's where the trust fund recovery penalty comes into. So the trust fund is the amount that was withheld from the employee's paychecks, not the matching, but just what was withheld. And they could be liable for that. So what you want to do is prepare the employee to answer the questions on what their duties were. And then they're going to ask, well, if you didn't do, like if you couldn't sign checks, who could? And so hopefully pointing the finger at somebody else. But definitely you can represent them and go to the 4180 interview with them and prepare them in advance to point the finger somewhere else.
All right, Roger. Let us know if you have any questions with that, with the 4180 interview. Moving on to Jessica. She's a CPA and also a VIP member, asking, CSED on a liability from 2003 has finally run out. Apparently there's been several tolling events that happened along the way, and I've verified through the transcripts that the liability has been written off. What happens to the liens filed? Can the taxpayer finally rest knowing that it's been written off? They've been living under a rock for many years.
So the answer is, the purpose of federal tax liens is to secure tax debt. If there's no collectible debt, then there's no purpose for the lien. And so when the debt becomes non-collectible through the collection statute expiring, then the liens should be released. And the liens usually takes them about 30 days. And if you order a transcript about 30 days after the CSAD, a little more, you should see that the liens have dropped off. So yeah, it's non-collectible, there's no lien, and the balance has been written off as uncollectible.
All right, and so the idea is, yeah, they can go back to their normal life now. They don't have to live
under a rock. Yeah, they don't have to live under a rock anymore because the IRS has forgiven the debt.
Right. All right. Good. Good luck there, Jessica. Moving on to Tracy, another VIP member. I have a case that I took to appeals. I received a letter stating that they accepted the appeal. The letter came almost a year ago, and I haven't heard anything since. Is there a way to follow up to see if the date if a date has been scheduled? Do you know approximately how long it takes to get on the docket to hear a case that is being appealed?
Yeah, appeals can take a while. It's not unusual for it to take a year or two. I mean, if you have a question, what I would do is when you receive the letter that said that they received the appeal, there should be a phone number on it. I would call the phone number on the letter that you got a year ago and ask what's going on. But it's not unusual. I wouldn't worry about it at this point. Like I say, it's not unusual for it to take a year or two. So, but if you do want to find out, I would call the number on the letter that you received saying that they received your appeal and ask them what's going on. Also, you might want to order a transcript and just see if the appeal, if the transcript shows that the appeal was received.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to Jeffrey. Jeffrey's an EA and is asking, I have a client that has considerable amount of savings in his IRA. In regards to setting up a partial pay installment agreement, will the IRS request a liquidation of the IRA account? Can they request proof that the IRA can't be liquidated? The IRA liquidation could potentially pay off 50 to 70% of the tax bill.
Okay, so the IRS isn't looking to liquidate the IRA, but I would need some further information. For instance, how old is the taxpayer? So is the taxpayer at the age where he can receive penalty-free distributions from the IRA? Also, does the IRA have any kind of provision that he can borrow against it? Because what they're looking at is if he could borrow, sometimes there's provisions that you can borrow 50% of the proceeds. And so they may want him to borrow against it and give the money to them and then pay them and then they can pay back the loan to their IRA on their own. The other thing is that if they do insist that the IRA be liquidated, you don't want to do it voluntarily, because if you do it voluntarily, if you do it voluntarily, then you're subject, depending on your age, you're subject to certain penalties, or if they levy it, that penalty is waived. So I would really need to know the taxpayer's age, and how much is in there, and what the provisions of the IRA are in terms of ability to borrow against it.
All right, thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Brian. When can a representative request a change of revenue officers? I live in a rural area of Wyoming and feel that if the revenue officer from a larger metropolitan area may serve my client better. Their expenses are higher than most in our area, and I think a different RO may sympathize better. Any thoughts?
Usually you can't pick and choose your revenue officers unless they did something that was clearly inappropriate. The one way around that is under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, the taxpayer is allowed representation. And you may want to argue. So for instance, if you live in a metropolitan area, but your client is in a rural area, you may ask for a revenue officer near your office, because you're going to be representing the taxpayer, and any meetings between you and the revenue officer need to be either at your office or at the revenue officer's office. And so that's the only way that I could see it, is if you live in a metropolitan area, even though your client doesn't. But if you live in a rural area, just like your client does, then no, they're not going to bring in a revenue officer from the city just because you don't like the revenue officer that's been assigned to your case.
All right, Brian, hopefully that answers your question. I want to spend just a couple minutes more on the upcoming event on November 14th. A lot of people ask, why should I attend? Well, some of the topics that are going to be covered are not only everything that we're talking about today, which includes appeals, audits, installment agreements, offers and compromise, innocent spouse, payroll taxes, tax court. All of these topics are definitely covered in the event. But also, just as important, are how to market your services, how to sell to the prospective clients. We're also going to be talking about discharging taxes and bankruptcy. And this year, we have some new presenters that are going to be doing a lot of this presenting to you. And Dan Weintraub is a bankruptcy attorney. He's going to talk about taxes. Yes, taxes are just chargeable in bankruptcy. We'll go into a lot of details there. Bruce Gibner, another attorney, is asking or will present on learn 14 ways to not pay capital gains tax. So if a lot of you are interested in capital gains tax and how to avoid paying that, Bruce Gibner is going to give a presentation on that. And Jeff Roller, he's a marketing guru and founder of ALM Advisors. He's going to show you guys how to grow your practice year after year with proven marketing and organizational strategies. So you're not only going to get tax resolution during this presentation, you're going to get a lot of other topics that are of interest and help you grow your practice. So this event is coming up on November 14th. As a reminder, those of you that cannot attend live or on the web on November 14th, there is going to be a rebroadcast on the 19th and the 20th, 4 hours each. So that way, for a combined of 8, so if you can't make the full 8 hours on November 14th, you can break it up on the 19th and the 20th. So again, I've pushed a link giving you details to the event. When you register now, there are also a bunch of freebies that you get that come along with the event. A lot of the textbook, a lot of the supporting documents to be able to create that course is provided to you so that you can read up on it prior to the event. So November 14th, mark your calendars, register now. That is coming up in just a few short, a week and a half now, actually. But all right, Norman, enough of that. Let's go ahead and finish up these questions that have been submitted prior to today's forum. I will be opening it up to the rest of you on the line in approximately 4 or 5 more questions that we have here. And some of you have already gone ahead and typed in your question. Please continue to do so. We'll do our best to get to all of them. So moving on, Gary is asking, under what normal circumstances will the IRS file a tax lien for amounts under $10,000?
Right. So if the taxpayer owes less than $10,000, filing a tax lien is discretionary with the revenue officer. So if you remember that the purpose of a federal tax lien is to secure the debt, then they'll file a lien if they feel that that there's some danger that the taxpayer won't pay the tax, and so they may look at if the taxpayer is a foreign national, is he going to move back to his home country? If he has an asset, are they afraid that he's going to dissipate that asset by selling or somehow transferring it? So there'd have to be some extraordinary reason why the IRS would be nervous about getting paid and wanting to protect their debt. They'd file a lien, but it's unusual. If we've had it where they've owed less than 10,000, but it's unusual. Maybe one issue is the CSED approaching soon, and so the taxpayer hasn't paid anything in the last 8 years, and they just want to file that lien, so at least they have a lien for the next 2 years. So those are the kinds of things that they would look at.
All right.
But the way around that would be to set up an installment agreement. So if you set up an installment agreement and you owe less than $10,000, they're not going to file a lien. So probably if you're worried about them filing a lien, probably the taxpayer hasn't paid anything on the debt.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Moving on to Edward. Edward is asking a question here regarding an OIC. And just to provide a little bit of a background, Edward is dealing with a taxpayer who's 74 years old, has about $90,000 in retirement account for emergencies and, of course, retirement. He wants to know whether or not we have access to IRC or equivalent that says that that retirement fund should not be used. But we'll get to that offline, Edward, and provide you some links there. During his offering compromise, he did not include the retirement account, and it looks like the offer specialist accepted that. And Norman, you'll explain under what circumstances retirement accounts are not counted as an asset, especially for those who are of retirement age. It looks like this offer specialist, though, even though they did not include the asset, refused to include the cost of some utilities, even though the proof of payment was provided. And it sounded like they wanted, there was a disagreement there, and the offer specialist just told Edward to go ahead and file an appeal, which sounds like he did. So his question is, if the appeal fails, can I submit a new offer? His thinking is that it may go to a more reasonable person. And then how long after we hear from the appeal officer, how long after we hear from appeal before we file a new OIC?
Okay, so the answer to the first question, if the appeal fails, can I submit a new offer? And the answer is yes, but I wouldn't submit the same offer hoping that you're going to get a more reasonable person. I would somehow make the offer different. The next question is, how long after we hear from appeal before we file a new OIC? So if the appeal comes back and the appeal is denied, you have further appeal rights, including a petition in tax court. And so I would look at the letter rejecting your appeal and either appeal the rejection, which I think is a good idea. Again, if you think you're right, I don't understand why they wouldn't include the cost of utilities if you had proof. And I would appeal the rejection of the appeal. Or if you just want to submit a new offer, I would wait until the appeal period expires. So if you have 30 days to appeal the rejection, then I would file a new offer after the 30 days. But I think better than that would be to appeal the rejection of the appeal.
Got it. And Norman, can you go into detail of when a retirement asset is not considered for offer purposes? That was one of his first questions.
So what they look at is what's necessary for the taxpayer to live a lifestyle in which he's accustomed to, so that when they retire or reach a certain age, that that they don't have to drastically affect their lifestyle because they're now retired. And so that amount is subjective because different people need different amounts to continue their present lifestyle. And so, for instance, even though it's an asset of the taxpayer and normally would be liquidated for the purpose of an offer, it's kind of like the effective administration, where if there's grounds where the taxpayer needs that asset, then it can be taken off the board and not used to satisfy the offer.
Got it. All right, Ed, hopefully that helps you there. Moving on to the next question is from Andrew. Client wants me to file 4 years delinquent returns because he knows he will owe for these years and wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. Can you explain the rules for discharging taxes? What is the waiting period?
Sure, I can. But I always say this because I'm a tax bankruptcy attorney. I've been practicing tax bankruptcies for 30 years. So those are bankruptcies that are driven by tax issues. And as the taxpayer's CPA or tax preparer or enrolled agent or something, you're really not qualified to give bankruptcy advice unless you're a bankruptcy attorney who specializes in tax issues. And so what you can basically tell the taxpayer is, I'll just go over these rules really generally. There's a 3-year rule, which says that the taxes are not dischargeable unless the due date of the return was more than 3 years prior to the bankruptcy. And that's including extensions. So for instance, if they owed for tax year 2015 and they had an extension and the due date of the 2015 return was October 15th, 2016, then the 3 years have just passed. And so 2015 and earlier would be dischargeable. 2016, 17, and 18 would not be. So one thing would be, are the 4 years, 15, 16, 17, and 18? You know, if so, 15 is going to be the only year that's going to be dischargeable at this time. And even that's not going to be dischargeable because now we go, and that's based on the 3-year rule, because we go to the 2-year rule, which is 2 years from when the return was filed. So if you're filing 4 years return now, then the 2-year rule wouldn't be satisfied for 2 more years after the filing. So that would be 2021. So now you're looking at, you're stretching it out for another 2 years. And the 180-day rule is 180 days from the date of assessment. But usually assessment date would be overshadowed by the 2-year and 3-year rules, unless there was some kind of audit assessment. And so basically what you could be telling the client is he may want to look into that, but, you know, he's not going to be subject to discharging the taxes in bankruptcy for another, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, depending on which year, you know, 4 years delinquent returns, how much he owes for each year. And so it's really something that's going to be quite a while down the road and not something where you, I think you said he wants to file bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. Well, that's not going to work. So collection action is going to begin way before those tax years are going to be dischargeable in bankruptcy. So filing bankruptcy triggered by collection action is not the way to go. You file bankruptcy in order to discharge the taxes, not to stop collection. He needs to get that explained to him by probably a bankruptcy attorney, or you can help in the meantime, after filing the return, setting up some kind of low payment plan.
All right, Andrew, if any questions there, consider becoming a VIP member and using some of that consultation time to speak to Norman, our bankruptcy specialist. On that same topic, Norman, Angie has a question. She says, what bankruptcy type is best to discharge old tax debt?
Which one is that?
Angie. Angie's asking, what bankruptcy type is best to discharge old tax debt?
Ideally, if you were going to file a chapter in bankruptcy, you'd want to file a Chapter 7, because a Chapter 7 is a liquidation, which liquidates all non-exempt assets. But ideally, all the taxpayers' assets are exempted, and so there won't be any liquidation or distribution to unsecured creditors in the bankruptcy. If to qualify for a 13, that would be second best, but in a 13, you're going to have to pay the Chapter 13 trustee a monthly payment for 5 years. So that may or may not be advantageous. And if you don't qualify for a 13 because you're over the debt limit, then you're going to have to do an 11. An 11 is a very expensive, drawn-out process. And unless you really have the ability to pay large bankruptcy attorney fees, you want to avoid an 11. So the short answer is, if you can file a Chapter 7 and discharge your debt without liquidating your assets, that's the best way to go.
All right. Thank you, Norman, for that. So I'm going to go ahead and start answering some of these questions that you guys have been submitting online. First one here is coming from Sebastian. After a long drawn-out process over a year, last month I was finally able to get the IRS to approve a streamlined installment agreement for my client for tax years 13 through 17. Their first payment is scheduled to be debited later this month, and I just found out that the client filed his 2018 return on 10/15, apparently had an extension, but owes a little bit over 20K and won't be able to pay it. The 13 to 17 liability was paid down below 100 to get the streamlined installment agreement approved, and now this will push them over again. Any recommendations to keep this installment agreement in place? What can I expect the IRS to do?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because I don't think anything you can do to keep the installment agreement in place. What's going to happen is they're going to receive a notice of intent to terminate the installment agreement because they violated one of the terms of the agreement, which was that they wouldn't incur additional tax debt. So they breached the installment agreement, and the IRS is going to terminate it. And usually when this happens, we ask the taxpayer, can you pay what you owe on the 2018 return? But here you say they can't pay it. So that's not possible. And then the thing is, they're going to be over $100,000. And in order to pay it down, it's just going to be the same as if they paid it with the return. So they're not going to get it down below $100,000 again. And the next question is, so now we're in November of 2019, and they obviously have been under withholding since 2013 and as recently as 2018. So the question is, do they also under withhold for 2019? So that even if you could straighten it out, are they going to owe again when they file their 2019 return? And that would be an issue. And then the other issue would be is they need to step up their withholding. So either if they're a W-2 employee, they need to withhold more from their paycheck, or if they're making estimated payments, they need to increase the amount of their quarterly estimated payments because they're obviously not paying in enough because they owe every year. So the question is, what's going to happen 2019? And then you need to draw a line in the sand and say in 2020, they're not going to owe anymore, that they're going to have sufficient withholding either through payroll or estimated payments to not owe in 2020.
Yeah, and remember, pushing it over that streamline now requires financials, which is going to be a little more intense.
But it may actually work in your favor because disposable income may be less than it would on a
streamline, yeah.
Because if a taxpayer owes $100,000 and he's in an extended streamline payment for $84 a month, I think that comes out to be about $1,200 a month. So maybe financials will show less and it will become a partial pay, because streamlined by definition is always a full pay.
Right.
But the thing is, you want to get your disposable income down, you want to be able to show that you're making estimated payments or having taxes withheld from your pay, that's going to lower your disposable income. So in either case, it behooves the taxpayer to step up the withholding so that they don't owe in the future and that they lower their disposable income.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Hopefully that helps you out there, Sebastian. Sharonda is asking, I have a client who qualifies for CNC. Two liens have been filed. If the client qualifies for a CNC, can you request that the liens be withdrawn to allow the client to qualify for a home mortgage?
Okay, that's going to be really tough because CNC is one thing, but first of all, you can't release a lien unless it's paid. So you would have to. So you're going to ask them to withdraw it, and the grounds for withdrawing a lien is that it benefits the IRS. So they're going to have to show how they're no longer going to be in CNC and they'll be able to enter into some kind of payment plan. So that would have to be the rationale, and you'd have to show how redoing their mortgage is going to benefit the IRS by getting them out of CNC and into an installment agreement.
Got it. Norman, we had a little glitch with the audio, so Sharonda wasn't able to hear your answer. Can you just very briefly go to the beginning of your response, please?
To which?
It's the same question. Same question. Refinancing the home. Yeah, audio cut out.
Right. So they're in currently non-collectible, but the IRS has a lien against their home to secure the debt. And so they're not going to release the lien because the only grounds to release the lien is if you full pay your tax. And they're not going to withdraw their lien unless it's in their best interest. So you would have to demonstrate how by withdrawing their lien and allowing the taxpayers to modify their mortgage or refinance or whatever is going to result in the taxpayers having a lower monthly mortgage payment, which will increase their disposable income and give them the ability to enter into an installment agreement and pay the IRS something every month. And so if the IRS sees that it's in their best interest, that their taxpayer is going to go from currently non-collectible to installment agreement status, then they may do it. They either withdraw it or subordinate it.
Yeah, and subordinating might be in their interest because now they have an asset to grab onto.
Right, but some mortgage holders won't do that even though they're superior to the IRS. They don't want any tax liens.
All right, sure.
Either in front of them or behind them.
Behind it, right. Hopefully that takes care of that for you, Sharonda. Sorry about that, guys. Looks like we had a small audio glitch there. Moving on to David. David is asking, on an OIC, how can you avoid the specialist going beyond the 12 and 24-month calculation?
Yeah, if you look at the 433A OIC, it explains that if they take the disposable income and multiply it by the number of months that are available to collect, that if they're going to get more through an installment agreement than they would with an offer, basically, then they'll deny the offer. The offer only works if they're going to get as much as or more than they would in an installment agreement, basically. And that 12 and 24 month number is really only works if there's not much time left in the collection statute.
Or very little disposable.
Right, or very little but disposable income, and it's just not worth it. But, you can't just rely on disposable income times 12 on a lump sum payment, for instance, and get that pushed through if the monthly disposable income is significant enough that if they spread it out over the collection statute, that they're going to get a lot more than the offer. If the disposable income is $100 or below, that's a different issue. Then they'd rather get paid up front.
Thomas is bringing up a very interesting point about our upcoming event on November 14th. Oftentimes, because of the different time zones, we broadcast this based on Pacific time. A lot of you folks are coming or attending via other time zones, including the East Coast. So the rebroadcast dates for November 19th and 20th, we broke them up into four-hour segments instead of full eight-hour segments. So they do begin at noon Eastern time. So that'll push you to 4 o'clock Eastern time for both of those dates. So if you are interested in attending the event and you can't do the full 8 hours because of the time difference, consider attending the November 19th and November 20th dates that break it up into smaller segments and allow you to go home at a decent time while you attend our event. But all right, guys, I appreciate everyone that submitted their questions ahead of time and those of you who submitted while we were on the forum itself. We did not get to all the questions, but it is that time. Remember, our next event is coming up on December 3rd. It'll be the last one of the year, so we're going to try to do something special for you guys then. But thank you again for attending today. Any questions, please feel free to give us a call or send us an email. I will send out an email with the event, more details on the event, and also a link to listen to this recording and also the recording of previous months so that way you can revisit some of these questions if you didn't catch all of it. Thank you again. Hope you guys have a great rest of your day. We'll see you again soon.